May it please the court, switch gears to a workers' compensation matter. It's kind of different stuff that I didn't know much about what they were arguing in that first case. It's a case of first impression on section 287.200.4 prem 3, which basically gave a new bucket, about $520,000 of damages to a person stricken with mesothelioma. That's the bare bones of this. I have the opportunity today to represent Bob Casey, who's deceased, and his life and death intersect with this this new statute, not because of his doing, but because of the fact that he contracted mesothelioma. Real briefly, Bob was a classic mesothelioma victim, worked 40 years in a construction trade where he was exposed to asbestos, retired, happy. 25 years later, gets mesothelioma, has a terrible death after about a year of dealing with mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is a cancer of the lining of the lung caused by breathing in asbestos fibers. The CDC says about that it peaked in about 2005 at 3,000 cases a year. That number has been declining because in 1974, the federal government start saying, you can't use this stuff, it's bad, it'll kill you. And so eventually it's working its way out of the system. But right now we think there's between 30 and 40 mesothelioma cases still in Missouri each year. That number is trending down. But here's the problem, is the latency period is from 15 to 50 plus years between exposure and the diagnosis of the disease. And so that makes things difficult in establishing remedies for this. But here's a very important point. Right now, there's virtually no one being exposed to the hazard of asbestos in Missouri because it's been cleaned up, because it's been abated from the schools starting in 1989 because of or 88 because of a federal law called the HERA. There just isn't a lot of new asbestos exposure. So with that backdrop, we say, well, how did we get to 287.200.4 Pren 3 that gives this new bucket of $500,000 worth of damages to a mesothelioma victim? Well, it happens because of the tort reform in 2005. Generally, the Workers' Compensation Act went into effect in 1926, I believe, in Missouri. And that was the grand bargain. Labor gave up the right to sue the employer. Management says, okay, we'll provide benefits for you in labor for what's happened to you through our Industrial Revolution. That was basically it. 1931, occupational diseases were accepted under the Missouri Workers' Compensation Law, only there was no statute that said they were accepted. It was because of liberal construction. So liberal construction continues to expand the occupational disease and workers' compensation law until 2005, and in 2005, tort reform comes in, and we have bad drafting that causes a loophole that says, oh, mesothelioma victims and all other occupational disease victims, the law doesn't say under strict construction that that we're covering occupational diseases in the sole remedy provision. And so what happens? All kinds of occupational disease people are suing their employers, including people with mesothelioma. In fact, it was an asbestos case in the Western District, State XRL, KCP&L, B. Cook, that caused the definitive point in 2011 where they say, occupational diseases are outside the scope of the sole remedy provision. You can sue employers. So then we have MATA, we have the business organizations in this turmoil because they say we've got to get occupational diseases back under the Workers' Compensation Act, but the people who represented individuals says, well, there's got to be some bargain again. And so what happened is in 2013, both sides got together and there was a compromise. And that compromise is 287.200.4 Prem 3. And that establishes, and I'm just dealing, there's actually 10 other occupational diseases that are by toxic exposure that are listed in the statute. But mesothelioma has special instructions and special ideals in the statute because mesothelioma victims generally didn't even bring workers' compensation claims. There's a case called Anyard that says, and the accident fund relies a lot on this Anyard case. It's a 1969 case that says what happens is if you're diagnosed with this disease 25 years, actually 17 years in Anyard, silicosis case, you're diagnosed with this disease, the insurer back here at the time of the last exposure is who covers the risk. And that generally was the law. Well, there's another case in 2011, I believe, and it's a W.R. Grace case. Am I totally flipping out on me? But it's W.R. Grace case, McGee versus W.R. Grace, that says, wait a minute, looking back at Anyard, they stipulated to the rate. The rate that you should use is the rate at the time of diagnosis and disability, not the time of the last exposure. So in this case, just hypothetically, Casey's rate back in 1990 when he was last exposed to asbestos was like $200 a week, the maximum rate. Well, now, in 2014, when he's diagnosed, it's $822 or $827 a week, and it's the state average weekly wage. So what happens is, we've got the Anyard case. We've got now Anyard isn't going to be followed because they stipulated to the rate there, and we've got the problem with Kuhn
case. And your time is more than half up. So how does this relate to what we should do in this case?
Okay, well let's go to the application of 287.200.4.3, and that is the additional benefits, and we say accident fund owes those additional benefits because they wrote a policy that said we're going to cover those additional benefits. It's very clear on that part.
And where does it clarify as to whether it's the employer at the time of the exposure or the employer at the time of the disability? And it's your argument that the regular, normally for a regular benefit, you look at the last employer to expose
you normally
them.
Do, and that is absolutely correct.
But now you're saying, what does the statute change?
Well, here's what happens. They say in that statute that you can do one of three things. You can either opt in or opt out. You can opt out and just say, you can sue me because I don't think that I've exposed you to the hazard of asbestos in any negligent way. Or you can stay inside the suit or stay inside the compact and have possibility of the $500,000 benefits, but it says you can purchase insurance, or you can join, or you can self-insure, or you can join the 287-233, the Missouri Mesothelioma Risk Management Fund, and that particular law says because it says at 287. 223.4, it says participation in the fund has the same effect as purchase of insurance. So that means you're going to purchase the insurance in the present tense. So what happened after the law, you've got a new bucket of damages, $500,000. It says you can purchase insurance, self-insure, or you can join this mesothelioma risk management fund. And
well, it says you have to elect now, but where does it say who has to elect?
Says
the employers have to elect, but where does it say which employer has to elect?
Well, the only employer that can elect is the employer who has last exposed them to the hazard.
Okay.
I think the substantive law hasn't changed on that. And so, Casey makes a claim against Cody. Cody says, I purchased my insurance. You look at the insurance policy, and the policy says, Section 287.200.4, Subdivision 3 of the Missouri Revised Statutes provides additional benefits in the case of occupational diseases due to toxic exposure. That's this bucket of damages. This is the 2014 policy purchased by Cody, and it says, your policy provides insurance for these additional benefits. So they've contracted to pay those benefits. Cody is responsible for. Everything in this, everything is postdates the statute.
And is it the insurer at the time of exposure or the insurer at the time of the election or both?
It's the insurer. Well, Matt argues it's both. I say it's the insurer at the time of the election because, and even, I mean, the policy itself, insurance companies can contract, and the policy itself says we're going to cover in 287-280, it says employers must insure their entire liability. So in 2014, Cody buys a policy from Accident Fund. It has to insure its entire liability at that time because of 287-280. And so they buy that policy. The policy in it has a measure of a notification of additional mesothelioma benefits that promises your policy provides insurance for these additional benefits. Now, if, as the accident fund argues, this is only for exposures in 2014, the legislature has passed a ridiculous law because nobody's being exposed to asbestos right now. You've got a 25-year period where the statute sunsets. So let's say Cody is still alive and he's working. In March of 2014, he's last exposed to the hazard, even though I don't think any hazard exists today. And he has the same latency period, and he's diagnosed in 2039, and he doesn't take it. That would be a scam for insurance companies to make money by selling policies that really don't have any chance of them ever having liability.
You're almost out of time, but could you discuss the constitutional issue on retroactivity?
Yeah, that's where I'm going, and I'm sorry. Well, the Constitution, the first part of the constitutional issue is everything in this case is prospective. You have to look at legislative intent, and the legislature said, let's look forward, and it says it only applies to claims brought on or after the effective date of the statute. And if you look at everything in the statute, or everything in this case, everything happened after the change in the law. The purchases or the law changes, Cody buys a policy, Accident Fund sells them a policy with an addendum that says mesothelioma coverage. Casey gets sick. Casey makes a claim. Accident Fund on the answer to the claim, or excuse me, Cody on the answer to the claim says, I've got insurance through Accident Fund, and so everything is prospective. And there's no the bottom line is there's no vested right in Cody to think the benefits under the comp law are ever going to change. And I'll address that more in my second half here. Thank you.
May it please the court. Just one comment about the W.R. Grace case. What that case held was that the available maximum compensation rate was determined on the date of the injury or the date of diagnosis. But in that case, the employee's actual earnings on the date of last exposure controlled what that compensation rate was. All that case ruled is that if that then compensation maximum rate was lower, that he could get the benefit of the more current higher rate.
Is that imposing an increased liability against the employer?
That did increase potentially the liability of the employer because that rate was higher than it was historically. That's correct.
So if one follows the constitutional argument, is that case wrongly decided?
I would submit yes, because that was a case that only spoke to the issue of the rate of compensation. I think this is a much broader issue with respect to the 2013 amendments. So I represent only Cody Company. When this case was litigated and through the course of the case to date, the claimants were only pursuing the enhanced benefit for mesothelioma. That is, they were not pursuing and have not been pursuing the traditional benefits for occupational disease. Why? Don't know for sure. It may be subrogation. But in any event, the only benefit that's being pursued is the benefit for which Cody Company had full coverage by Accident Fund. Over the course of this case, though, the insurer has evolved to the point where, well, if the policy language doesn't protect us, and if we can't convince the courts that the policy only applies if 25 years down the road someone contracts mesothelioma who was last exposed during this current policy period, or in this case 2014, then perhaps everything should relate back to the then insured under the traditional last exposure rule. Of course, Cody Company, it was fully insured in 1990 when Mr. Casey last worked. California Compensation Insurance Company went belly up in 2010, 10 years later. Another 14 years later, Mr. Casey is diagnosed with mesothelioma. So that then potentially exposes Cody Company currently. So my job is to argue to protect Cody Company. And I believe that if, in fact, the 2013 amendments are constitutional, that the enhanced benefit should be covered by the insurer who wrote the meso endorsement in effect on the date of diagnosis. However, as to the constitutionality issues, you know, I've been a work comp defense lawyer for 48 years, and I've never seen any changes as dramatic as happened in 2013. And as to the argument that this is a dread disease, mesothelioma, as are the other nine diseases due to occupational exposure, but I've seen quadriplegics at 18 years old or 21 years old. If those accidents happened today, those individuals would still be, they would be related to a second-class citizen compared to a mesothelioma employee.
So I are you addressing the constitutional issues, or is Mr. McPherson?
Well, again, I've largely deferred to action funds, so I will at that point. But
pardon?
I will, in fact, not get into that any further.
And Mr. McPherson will?
I believe. In any event, okay. We're sharing our time equally, so I don't want to, but I just wanted to state that in addition to arguing the coverage issue,
well,
I'd also
can you argue specifically on statutory construction here? What in the statute indicates that the legislature intended to change to the insurer at the time of diagnosis as opposed to the insurer at the time of last exposure?
Well, I think when they provided the...
Or vice versa.
The option, when they created these new benefits and then made the employer either opt in or opt out...
And they require the employer clearly currently to do that, but they don't talk about insurers. I know the word employer means insurer, but how do we resolve that here?
I think it's hard to... You know, this is such a dramatic and a different animal, these new benefits. It's very difficult to put this into perspective. And to, it seems to me that if, in fact, these benefits, you know, are enforceable, and if the law is constitutional, then it then should fall on, in that perspective, it should fall on the insurer who wrote the policy now.
But the shoulds really are for across the street. So luckily for us, if there's an answer in the statute, we just follow that and we don't worry about which one would be better or worse. So is there something you can use to assist us in understanding? Because it's unclear since it doesn't directly talk about insurer. Talks about employer, and if we substitute the word insurer for employer, as we're to do, there's still two possible insurers. How are we to figure out which one?
Well, I think that the reference to the employer means insurer when it, except when it doesn't. When there is a conflict, in fact, between the two, then I think you have to deal with them as individual entities, and I think that's what we're...
Well, although 287-200 doesn't talk about the last exposure rule, we still have 287.063 that still refers to the last exposure rule. So is that still applicable under our new 2014 amendment?
Well, again, I think that when the 2013 amendments were drafted and were adopted, I think they didn't do a very good job in looking at what conflict that may have caused with the, you know, long existing benefits or the long existing provisions of such as 063. So,
I don't think either of you can test that it's the employer at the time of last exposure. The question is, which insurer, or is it both insurers? If I understand
correctly, I think
that's
correct. We do know that liability attaches to the last expose the employer. That has not changed.
Right.
So it's the issue is, as to the new benefit, does that
and as to the traditional benefits, it's the same, that last exposure.
Putting company is insured in both cases, in both situations. So. They have the current insurance and they have the prior insurance.
And in this case, the insurer from the time of exposure is no longer in business, so there's no insurance for that?
There's no insurance.
That
and MIGA, Missouri Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association, refused to accept a claim or defend because the bar date, obviously, it passed 14 years earlier. But of course, the Cody Company had no knowledge of, they couldn't foresee a 25-year in the future claim for mesothelioma.
If your client made a current election, it says in order for an employer to make an election, they provide the department with notice of an election. And did your client do that?
Well, the work comp law is that they either accept or reject. They either reject or accept by purchasing a mesothelioma endorsement. And every insurer gives them that option post 2014. So they simply purchase coverage for mesothelioma. They're my electing.
I think Mr. McPherson is ready to make his part of the argument.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. May it please the court, and thank you, Jess Sith, for bringing me on stage. If I could respond to the last line of questioning,
please,
that Your Honor was directing to Mr. Kennedy. I represent Accident Fund, and the what you've heard this morning is that the claimant wants to go after the last insurer standing. The employer wants to go after the last employer standing. The answer to the question that the court is proposing is found in the statute. It's in, as Judge Russell noted, 287.063. It's the last exposure rule, determines which employer and which insurer are liable for a claimant's compensation. Now,
But the plaintiff says that you issued a claims-made policy, and that the claim was made currently while you were currently insuring them, and that was your choice. You didn't have to issue a policy, but you chose to.
Your Honor, that is exactly what the claimant says, and the claimant is not right on that.
Okay, tell me
this
why
is
not.
By on its face, this is an occurrence policy, and indeed, it's undisputed, all workers' compensation policies are occurrence policies.
So they misinterpret your policy?
That is a way of saying that, Your Honor, yes. And by the way, this policy, this is not a mesothelioma.
Didn't the occurrence occur after 2014 when the claim was made? Because that's what the statute says. It doesn't say injury. It says that all claims filed after January 1st, 2014. So didn't the occurrence occur after 2014?
Well, Judge Powell, you're drawing a distinction that's important. There's a difference between a claim and an occurrence. And it's certain, it's sure, this statute applies to claims from 2014 and forward. No doubt about that. We know what a claim is. That's when you go to the office and you file a paper. That's not what an occurrence is. That is not what an exposure is. In that same statute, 287-200, is part of the workers' compensation law, which is a unified code to be read in par materia. It includes 287-063, and indeed, that's why we're here today. The last exposure rule is why we're here today.
But your policy specifically says that you cover under this new statute, and the new statute says that their enhanced benefits are available if a claim's filed after January 1st, 2014?
Well, Your Honor is right about that, and I'm not picking a fight with you over what the policy says or what the statute says. Well, what does the statute say? It says that the last exposure rule, the statute 287-200, that's the change we're talking about, doesn't write out 287-063.
Fair enough.
And that's the only reason we're here, 287-063.
Couldn't both insurance companies be on the hook then?
That's not what the statute says, and that's what all the cases interpret.
I don't see where it says that two insurers couldn't be on the hook.
The 287-200 doesn't, as Judge Stiff has noted, doesn't say what insurer is on the hook for what. 287-200 says that there is this benefit that you can opt into, and you have to insure it going forward.
Why isn't it the insurer that's elected?
Well, Your Honor, on behalf of Accident Fund, we are here to say that this is an insurance policy, and it's possible that claims could be made under it. This is not one of them, because
so
this occurrence did not.
What claims could be made? You're saying it would only apply to current exposures.
to occurrences during the policy period by the plain terms of the policy.
But as everyone agrees, no one gets exposed anymore, so you're not really providing anything.
Your Honor, I don't think anyone has agreed to that. That was something that someone said, but I'm here to disagree with it. People get exposed to things. There are asbestos, egg,
but that's all your, this is an occupational policy, and that's all your, you're saying all you are covering is current exposure, but the claim won't be made for 25 years if
it may not.
Current exposure.
And that is the way all of these policies have worked. What you're hearing today is that inferentially, sub silentio, 287-200 decrees that all workers' comp policies going forward have to be claims-made policies. And respectfully, the statute does not say that. And we heard something a minute ago today that the reason we're here is because the legislature sent across the street 287-800, which requires strict construction of the statute, that it no longer a liberal construction. It requires a strict construction, which means that nothing is read into it, nothing is read out of it, nothing is inferred.
And our current cases have said we don't read, if it's clear, we don't read anything into it anyway, liberal or strict construction. But if it's ambiguous, then we have to do what? Because here it does not clearly answer this question. So how does strict or liberal help us understand what the legislature meant?
Well, Your Honor, I agree. This statute is unambiguous. Well, maybe I don't agree.
I don't think I was saying it was unambiguous.
I'm saying that the statute is unambiguous. This statute unambiguously talks about the additional benefit for mesothelioma. There's no doubt about that. Unambiguously does not say word one about which insurer is on that risk.
So how do we figure out which insurer? Isn't it? My point is, if we can't find anything that specifically assists us in either statute in addressing that, isn't that the definition of ambiguity? And then how do we resolve that ambiguity today under strict construction?
Your Honor, I don't see where the ambiguity arises from the terms of this statute, but where would you get guidance? The court could get guidance from a really learned, the Feltrop case from the Western District in 1997, which Your Honor...
I remember the name.
Well, and so that's an important case. That is the claimant mentioned Enyard. Enyard is a case that talks about the last exposure rule, and it's a silicosis case 17 years after the fact. That case holds that even if you come forward with a claim today under 287-063, the last exposure rule, which has been enforced consistently, the insurer that was on the risk on the date of last exposure is the one that is liable. And it's undisputed, and I think this even comes from Matta's brief, which was mentioned by the claimant, that all of these policies are occurrence policies, and they all sweep in the state of the law at the time. This policy, it was written in light of 287-063, which is part of the same statute that 287-300 and 400 are in. There is no basis to hold this in the statute or in the policy to hold this insurer liable for an occurrence that occurred undisputedly in 1990.
And what is it you're saying your current policy covers again? Claims or occurrences that occur now? What is the
occurrences
language?
During the policy period, like every occurrence-based policy.
And it doesn't say claims, it says occurrences.
It mentions claims, Your Honor. It talks about which claims are mentioned both in the statute and in the policy. It doesn't say that it pays for the mesothelioma benefit for claims asserted in 2014 by its plain terms, Your Honor, and I will refer the court, it's set forth at length in our brief, it's in the legal file. The policy is an occurrence policy, and it is not a mesothelioma policy. It is a standard workers' comp policy that is based on the law.
Well, you had a mesothelioma endorsement. You're required to have that if you were electing.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's what I'm saying is a mesothelioma endorsement on a standard occurrence policy. It's read together.
Right.
And the statute is read together. There's nothing about this statute that says that the last occurrence rule was read out of the statute. And I appreciate the court's indulgence in letting me go over.
Can I ask one quick question?
I'm here all day, Judge.
The statute also indicates that for the employer to make the election, that the employer shall provide the department with notice. Do you know if any notice was provided by Cody in this matter?
I don't believe that any issue of notice has been raised in the case, Your Honor. I don't believe that that is a topic that the parties have addressed, and as I stand here, I cannot answer that question for you.
You've conceded you elected coverage, but you haven't. Is that coverage was elected under the mesothelioma?
don't dispute that the Cody company purchased the policy. Okay. It's got the mesothelioma coverage. We don't dispute that. Okay. All we're disputing, Your Honor, is whether this insurer is on the hook. And under the last
You're saying rule, it is not. Both of them are occurrence policies, and the definition of occurrence didn't change.
It did not. It's a standard form policy. It says whether every occurrence, and not to go over any farther, but in response to your question, what we're hearing today is that every policy that's written today that includes mesothelioma coverage.
Could I beg the Chief Justice's indulgence? I realize we never let you get to the Constitution. If you could, in 1 minute, make a brief
okay.
argument.
May I say the last thing first?
Yes.
Okay. That there is no indication in this statute that the legislature, the folks across the street, decided that they wanted to make all current insurers pay an extra $500,000 for each of these past decades-old asbestos claims. There's nothing in the statute that says that. There's nothing in the statute that says all of these policies are going to be claims-made policies going forward. Let me answer Your Honor's question.
But let me interrupt just a second, then I want you to answer that question, too. But so what was the basis of the bargain when the legislature passed this? I mean, you all escaped the kind of common law liability. What was the burden put on you?
Oh, well, Your Honor, it's $500,000 per claim. What we're here to talk, and we don't dispute the amount that was awarded in this case. The number is the number. What we're talking about is who gets it. This statute doesn't make any sense if you read it other than prospectively.
Well, isn't it an illusory remedy if current insurers aren't responsible for it?
Is an illusory remedy if the current insurer is not responsible for it? That's
you get 300% of nothing if there's no insurer.
Well, Your Honor, it's not that there's no insurance coverage. Where we are here, the reason we're here today is because, as Mr. Kennedy mentioned, the insurer that is on the risk, the insurer to which the statute points, went out of business.
Right.
That's the reason we're here. What's sought to be done today is that the law is going to be perverted for the Casey family, and I'm very sorry for their loss. There's no doubt that they suffered, but the law should not be contorted for one case. They say hard cases make bad law. This would make extremely bad law going forward for all employers and insurers.
Okay, so then why do you say this is substantive law as opposed to maybe remedial and talk about the retroactivity constitutional argument?
Sure, Judge. You talked a bit, I think, to Mr. Kennedy, maybe slightly to Mr. Mack, about what can change. The case you talked about was one where the schedule of benefits changed in years past and was held that's not a substantive change. That's just a remedial change because it literally goes just to the remedy. But this statute, for example, cuts off the employer and inferentially the insurer's subrogation right. And Your Honor knows from the Liberty Mutual case that is a substantive right that's being cut off. The right of the employer and the insurer to seek subrogation that is cut off in this statute,
but
as Mr. Mack said.
Counsel, our cases are clear, and the retrospective laws prohibition is read really very narrowly. And our cases are clear. You have no right to depend on there not being a change in the law. The law will change, and you can't claim that's retrospective application. And they also say it's okay, you rely on pre-existing facts as long as there's some change currently. So you're applying for a license. Well, you can't say, well, gosh, this defect in my property that precludes me getting a license was a pre-existing fact, therefore the law would be retrospective. No, you're making the change currently, trying to get a license. And here, you didn't have to issue the policy. You weren't being held responsible for this 300% automatically just based on antecedent facts. It's on the fact that you issued a current policy that you would be, if it covers, and I'm not saying it does. But I don't understand your argument there's anything retrospective about this, because we enact new legislation all the time in this state and issue new cases, and they don't violate the retrospective laws rule because they're based on some current event which in part relies on antecedent facts, and our courts have said everything relies in part on things that have gone before it. That's okay.
Your Honor, we're always talking about what happened in the past. There's no doubt about that. But the cases are clear that the workers' compensation law cannot be changed to alter vested rights. For example, the Liberty Mutual case, Judge Russell wrote on the Court of Appeals, a change.
But if it's based on your decision to issue a mesothelioma endorsement, and if we were to agree with plaintiff that in fact that was then meant you were, it was the time that of diagnosis that applies, which is a question you all disagree on. That's not based on something that happened back in 1990. That's based on your decision now to issue that endorsement, and if you're liable for it under the law, then you are. It's nothing retrospective about it.
Well, as to the second part of that, if you're liable under the law, under this statute...
I understand that's a different argument.
Well, and you're going to a constitutional issue. That would be a very basic due process violation. To have a statute that doesn't say you're on the hook is... inferentially allowed to put you on the hook. That is not what the law is. It's not what the statute says. It's not what the court's cases say. That's not what the policy says. Respectfully, this award is contrary to the statute and the policy, and Accident Fund would respectfully request that the award be reversed. I may not have answered every question, but I know when I'm ready to leave. Thanks. Accident Fund appreciates the court's time.
Thank you.
May it please the court again. The constitutional argument, you have to look at the legislative intent. That's what the cases say. The legislative intent is remedial in this case. They want to give a benefit for something, for a wrong that has happened, and they want to protect that benefit. It's all prospective in its language, too. It says it doesn't apply to anything that happened before this happened.
The question, if we accept that argument,
right,
that the intent of the legislature is clear, does the Constitution allow them to do that?
Yeah, I think it does, because there's no vested interest in E.J. Cody and Company having believing that they're never going to have to pay more on a work comp case, and that goes back to 287-200. And that's where this all is. It's all in the statutes about permanent total disability and the amount to be paid. And it's so instructive here, because it says compensation for permanent total disability shall be paid during the continuance of disability from the date of maximum medical improvement for lifetime of the employee at the weekly rate of compensation in effect under this subsection on the date of injury. And that can be an occurrence. The date of injury can be an occurrence, and that's what happens in this case. Is the date of injury is when we have that. There's no case until the date of injury when the doctor says you've got mesothelioma and you have disability.
And so there's case law that define the date of injury as the date of diagnosis. The cases define the date of injury as the day of diagnosis, clearly, and not the date of last exposure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because until you manifest the result of the exposure, right, there's not an injury.
Right. I should remember this. There's a case from our office. It's not a comp case, but
I'm sure it's in your briefs. I know you addressed this.
Yeah. So we've got that.
Excuse me. Do you agree with Mr. McPherson that this is in the an occurrence policy?
It's an occurrence policy. It's a claims made policy, because the statute said for all claims made after this.
Which one is it now? You said both.
No.
Is it
it's
claims
not an
made
occurrence.
Or occurrence?
It's not an occurrence policy. It's a claims made policy.
Well, does their policy say occurrence?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know. It says they're going to cover.
Your point is that with respect to the new mesothelioma benefits, it's a claims made policy.
Absolutely. And that's
not that the entire policy and every claim.
Right. That's the only chunk that we're covering with the claims made. And that's if you look at 287-223, the mesothelioma statute put in place for a pool for these people, that's a claims made policy. It says in it that
is there anything in the record regarding underwriting as to how premium was charged for the endorsement?
There is nothing that I'm aware of. No, there's nothing in the record. But insurance companies, that's what they're in the business of, is assessing risk, making an assessment, trying to make money by issuing a policy on this risk. And it's obvious that they accepted this risk because they wrote a mesothelioma endorsement. They claim that a policy in 1990 should apply. Can't opt
no,
out
they're,
of it.
They're saying that the insurer from 1990 is the one who has to pay for it if the
right,
employer
saying,
elects.
But that
and would have to write a new rider or otherwise be fully liable.
How does that 1990 insurance company opt out? How does that insurance company in 1990 issue a mesothelioma endorsement? They can't.
Well, if they're still in existence, they can, and that way they don't get sued in civil court.
Well, I suppose they could, I don't know by practice of any that they're doing that at all.
Counselor, you're out of time.
I've got one last question.
Ma'am.
Does 200.4 change the employer's liability or just change the amount of the award?
No, there's nothing about the employer's liability. It's all about the amount of the award. There's nothing that changes. You determine how the employer is liable in exactly the same way as whoever is last exposed to the hazard. The substantive law does not change. Thank you.